Session number 887.
Colonel Seddon Real One, before we start talking about your experiences with tanks and the signals, could you just tell me a bit about your home and family background, where you were brought up, what prompted you to go into the army, that kind of thing?
Surely. I was born in India of Indian Army parents, and my grandfather, again, was a soldier, and but before him there were other soldiers. And I think I drifted into the army simply as a more or less a fait accompli. I was expected to, in fact, I was originally expected to go into the Navy, but I didn't like the sea, so I drifted into the army quite happily. I just take it for granted.
Yes. Your father was an Indian Army.
He was an Indian Army. Soldier.
Yes. Cavalry, infantry?
No, infantry. He commanded the 19th Punjabis, and much to his regret, he was just a bit too old to go to the war. And he did sort of peacetime chores in India, commanding troop ships and commanding depots and various things.
Mm. Family tradition being what it is, I suppose it wouldn't have been surprising had you gone into an Indian Army regiment.
Well, funnily enough, when I came home from India, I felt that India was a place that I knew all about, and I was much more interested in seeing the rest of the world. Or else, anyway, I wasn't particularly keen on going back to India. Later on in my life, I wished I'd been more interested in it, because it was a great place to be.
Yeah. How early on did you become interested in one of the specialist arms, and was it always signals, or
well,
were your ideas of
it? Yes, as a schoolboy, quite young, I began tinkering with bits and pieces of Rala sets and making crystal sets and so on, and a very early valve set, and I was always interested in, well, the technical side, I think, of wireless, and wireless generally. I was fascinated.
Yes. You went to the shop at Woolwich in 1927 as a officer cadet. Did that further your interest in signals in general and wireless in particular?
No, I was far too busy being taught to be a soldier. It was a very hard life at the shop. One was kept extremely busy. One had to run between assignments, between drill and riding and classroom work and so on, and one had never had a moment to think at all of anything except the job one was on, which is, I think, of an extremely good training for budding soldiers.
I suppose when you went to the Royal Corps of Signals headquarters at Kattery, you started getting more down to the nitty-gritty there.
Oh, yes. This is the course which was designed, really, to, having received one's basic military training at the shop, the period at Kattery was entirely devoted to professional, specialist training for the Royal Corps of Signals.
What part did wireless figure in that training?
Well, it figured, but it was a very, very primitive kind of wireless. We had, in fact, some wireless equipment which must have been years old and pretty well obsolete, but which still worked and was, I think, learnt our basics from it. The 120-watt set, which, I don't know when it originally appeared in the army, but that was one of our equipments we were trained on, which employed a thing called a coherer tube, which I don't suppose many people remember ever happened, but it was there. And the other sets, oh dear, I've forgotten now, but they were very elementary indeed.
Did your first professional appointment to the armoured fighting vehicles signals at Tidworth come as a surprise to you? What was the circumstances of it?
Well, it was sheer potluck. I was surprised. I'd never heard of it before. I was expecting to be posted to an infantry divisional signal unit. And when this one came, I was delighted, as soon as I found out what it was all about.
It seemed like a good appointment for
you. It was a very good appointment, as far as I was concerned.
In the event, it started a connection that you had with tanks and wireless that lasted nearly a decade.
It lasted the whole of my service.
Yes. With the sort of wisdom of hindsight, do you think, are you glad that degree of specialisation attended so much of your service?
Well, I became fascinated very early on, and I remained fascinated with all my service.
In 1930, when you went to armoured fighting vehicles, what was the sort of nature of the relationship between the Royal Corps of Signals and the Tank Corps?
Well, it was a very happy relationship. We lived, as I told you before, we lived with our tank regiment. I think I'd better call it a regiment, not a battalion, because then nowadays it's a regiment. In those days it was a battalion and company and now it's regiment and squadron. Well, we lived with it throughout the summer, all the whole summer training season, what used to be called collective training, and I was extremely happy with the regiment. I went first of all to the 5th Royal Tank Regiment in 1930, and subsequently to the 2nd Regiment, 2nd Royal Tank Regiment at Farnborough in 1933 or 4, I'm not quite sure which. And there I had a very interesting time indeed, because not only was I involved with the my particular job of commanding the tank regimental signal section, but also some experiments were being made in those days with remote controlled tanks by the, now what was the, it was the Fighting Vehicles Research Establishment, FRDE, Fighting Vehicles Experimental Establishment, I've forgotten exactly what it was called, at Farnborough, which was playing with remote controlled aircraft and remote controlled tanks, and I got mixed up in that to my huge delight.
I think I put my question rather badly when I asked what the relationship between the Tank Corps and the Corps of Signals was. What I was really getting at was, did the Tank Corps in 1930 have any wireless specialists of its own, or was it entirely reliant
upon the Royal Corps Signals?
I see.
And we were treated as rather special people.
So there was a total dependence on signals.
There was a total dependence.
Yes. From the point of view of the interests of the Tank Corps, do you think that total reliance on the Corps of Signals was a good thing, a desirable thing?
Well, at the time...
Did it have any disadvantages?
At the time, it was inevitable, because it was a new thing, this wireless, really, in the Army. It was regarded, I think, by the Army at large, as a rather sophisticated and specialised thing, which was beyond their ken. And we were the specialists, and we were expected to produce the results, but which they couldn't conceivably have done for themselves.
That was the kind of thing that was going through my mind. I wondered whether, in their total reliance on the Corps of Signals, it was actually a deterrent to the Tank Corps personnel to become wireless-minded themselves.
Well, I don't think so. I think that the Army at large, apart from the Technical Corps, were rather suspicious of anything technical and felt that they hadn't got what it takes to learn about it, and that they had to rely on the specialists. They were, I think it was rather like the relationship between the ordinary people and their doctors. The doctor is a chap who's a person apart. And we were in that sort of relationship, I think, in a way.
Now, you went to Tidworth to join Armoured Fighting Vehicles Signals in about April 1930. When you went to Tidworth, what at the time was the size, the organisation and the resources of AFV Signals?
Well, now, it was a unit of squadron size. It had a headquarters, an administrative element, of course, plus all the tank signal sections for the four tank regiments which we were then concerned with, plus a workshops section and sort of maintenance facilities, which covered the whole of the organization and training and technical backing for the whole of the armoured corps as it then existed.
At Tidworth, apart from the tank battalion signals sections, was there any signals components for the mechanised cavalry regiments?
Yes, there were two signal troops. One which was with the 11th Hussars and one with the 9th Lancers, both of which came under the wing of the of AFV signals.
I see. Now, concentrating next on the tank battalion signal sections themselves, what were their size in terms of men? And what was their organisation and what kind of equipment did they have?
Well, now, the size, there was a subaltern commanding, a section sergeant. I cannot precisely remember the establishment, but there were so many corporal NCOs, operators, who operated the tanks down to squadron level, at squadron headquarters, that is. And there were the maintenance personnel, that is, instrument mechanics and fitters, who had to cover the unit maintenance, you might call it, apart from the technical backing provided by the Ordnance Corps, the unit maintenance and battery charging.
The two cavalry regiment signals troops that were also at Tidworth, were they different in any ways to the tank battalion signal sections?
No, they were pretty similar. They had precisely the same role and the same equipment. There were problems which were they're different in some ways. I think they were rather larger. They had to try to achieve greater ranges. I don't know whether they did or not. They kept themselves rather to themselves, and I wasn't myself at that time concerned at all, and I can't tell you very much more about them. But their general role and purpose and organisation was pretty similar.
Could you tell me a bit about the background to AFV signals? I mean, when was it set up?
Now, that I'm afraid I don't know. That I can't tell you. Is it still working?
Yes.
It can't have been more than about 3 or 4 years old when I joined it, but precisely when it was formed, I'm afraid I don't know.
Yes. Because I was actually rather surprised that there were two signals troops for the 11th Hussars and the 12th Lancers, which had only been mechanised in
12th Lancers, right, not 9th, 12th, yes.
Mm. I'm surprised that they'd set up the signals troops for the two cavalry regiments in view of how recently they'd been mechanised.
Well, they were in existence before I joined, yes. AFE Signals. How long they'd been going, I just don't know. We had, of course, a horse cavalry troop at the same time, which looked after the cavalry brigade, and that was, although sort of slightly associated with us, wasn't actually part of AFE Signals.
During the period you were with AFE Signals, from 1930 to 1934, did it grow at all in size and its range of functions?
No, it didn't grow either in size or range of function at all. There were developments, of course, as developments took place in, well, slowly, very slowly, actually, in the equipment and the training and the ideas which were beginning to emerge about how signalling should develop. But no, there was no change in role or in size or establishment.
Did AFE Signals have any other relationships, like, for example, with Signals Research and Development Establishment? I'm wondering, who did the experimental design and development work, what your relationship with other signals-orientated groups was?
Well, SRD took an interest, a close interest, in us and our equipment, and we did get to know some of the personnel of SRD, and there was, I think, a very useful liaison between us. But this was, I think, informal, and I don't know whether it was officially recognised. I think probably not.
Hmm. So SRD didn't actually didn't provide you with any backup of any kind?
No, they did not. But sometimes they sent individual experts to look at problems and presumably to gain some knowledge of what went on in tank communications. And we did have some personal relationships with their experts, but beyond that there was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it was official, I think it was just natural.
Yes. I was wondering, for example, whether it was SRDE which produced the crystals for you?
Oh, yes. There was a great crystal expert, one Miss Wilson, who personally, I think, ground these crystals. And we all knew Miss Wilson and regarded her as the crystal wizard.
What were her sort of methods, and how much output could she manage working on it?
Now, that I can't tell you, I'm afraid. That I just don't know.
Okay. Well, let's concentrate on the work at Tidford. You explained to me that your year was divided between the 6 winter months at Tidworth and then the 6 summer training months with the battalions. I'd like to get some details of the Tidworth period, first of all. What was your routine activities at Tidworth? What kind of things were you doing there?
Well, as a young officer, and with my young officer colleagues, we were ourselves being trained in being soldiers. And, of course, the soldiers themselves had to be trained in their military duties, apart from the specialized business of tank communications. This all went on continuously during the winter training season, which was called in those days the individual training season. And we had to study for promotion exams and generally learn our trade as officers of the Royal Corps Signals. And, of course, the soldiers, the same thing applied to them. At the end of the individual training season, first the soldier had to be taught his trade. We had operators, we had instrument mechanics, we had fitters, we had drivers, to name the main divisions. We had general duty men who had no job at all except, as you might say, general duties. All these men had to be trained, and we were responsible, we junior officers, for those who happened to be under our command, or else, that is to some extent, but also, of course, we were allotted specific roles. There might be an officer who was in charge of operator training. I was, for a time, in charge of workshop training. And this took a pretty fair part, in fact, most, I think, of the winter training season, because collective training, which was the next stage, was really the stage we reached when we joined our tank units. So although we had some exercises before joining our tank units, where we had to set up communication systems and prove that we could make them work.
So the personnel of the signals sections, there were specialists, and the main ones were the operators on the one hand and the mechanics on the other, is that right?
That is right. That
I
is
see.
It.
As far as the operators were concerned, what kind of procedures did you use in their training?
Well, a good deal of it was Morse training. This had to be done very thoroughly. We had to reach a pretty high standard in Morse signaling. And this went on continuously until the operator... You see, there were once an operator was qualified, as in, for example, an operator wireless and line, there were 3 grades, there was, or classes, you might say class 3, class 2, and class 1. And once a soldier, probably as an NCO, had achieved class 1, well, then he was a real operator wireless and line and a very skilled man. But one had to try and upgrade the lower grades and, of course, naturally enough, teach the novices how to begin on this trade.
Mm-hmm.
And this was quite a considerable work.
For the operators, what was the balance in their training between wireless telephony on the one hand and telegraphy, that is Morse, on the other?
Well, now, they had to learn the official radio telephony procedures. But the strange thing was that the radio telephony procedure, as practiced in the Royal Corps Signals and used throughout the Army, was a much more rigid and more involved kind of procedure than it was possible when we were with our tank units, because the tank corps had a different problem. It had to be much briefer and with a large number of sets on one net, up to 50 on one net, there was little time to talk, and there was much less time for the procedure which was laid down in the book, the radio telephony procedure, which in point of fact we more or less, I won't say ignored, because the basis of it was effective throughout the army, but it had to be much abbreviated. And I don't think there was much emphasis in our individual training season on the kind of procedure we were going to use during the summer.
I see. That was kept until the summer training.
Well, it just happened when we got to our units, because the tank corps by this time rather developed its own methods, which were the right methods for their purposes.
Yes. Fine. So much for the operators. The mechanics, what range of duties did they have to be taught to master?
Well, the instrument mechanics were the ones whose job it was to maintain the signals equipment. They, in point of fact, covered more than wireless. They covered line instruments and signals equipment, all the technical signals equipment generally in their trade. But, of course, in our particular role, when we got out to our units, they were concerned exclusively, you might say, with wireless. They had a high standard of instrument-making skill, which they had to learn during the individual training season, use of lathe, use of tools, instrument making generally. They were very good, skilled workmen at their trade.
And these two groups we've talked about were the main specialists.
They were the main specialists. Well, of course, there were also the fitters, whose job was, vehicles and battery charging and that kind of work. So they were the two groups we were concerned with. Of course, battery charging was one of our duties with our units.
You've mentioned that at Tidworth there were a certain amount of wireless exercises. Could you tell me a bit about those exercises, how you organised them, what kind of purposes they were set up for, and what you learned as a result of them?
Well, we had to use wheeled vehicles, naturally, in the earlier stages, although later on we had one or two armoured command vehicles. This is much later on, as the war was heaving in sight. Wireless sets, MBMCs, were installed in lorries, and, there might be possibly half a dozen at a time, because we hadn't got all that number of vehicles. And we drove out along the roads and maintained communication. And this was the object, just to practice the operators and the officers too in running a small communication system. And this needed a good deal of time and effort in order to get both officers and soldiers to be able to do this effectively. And we had, by the time we reached our units, we had to be experts in this.
These exercises were closely related to the kind of functions you would have with the battalions, right?
No, they were not. They were just exercises in communication, maintaining communication over practical distances.
I see.
But there was very little tactical, in fact, practically no tactical aspect to these exercises.
Yes. You've mentioned that in the work of the AFV signals, you had a good deal of practical support from the Ordnance Corps. Would this be the appropriate time to bring in that relationship?
Yes, I think it would. Happily, there was an Ordnance workshops at Tidworth, and it so happened that most of us young signals officers lived in the same mess, which happened to be the RAMC mess in Tidworth, with the Ordnance officers, and we made relationships with them, and we worked very, very closely with them. And this was a very great value when it came to the general maintenance of all our equipment. We were able, for example, if we had gotten a bit of bother, to ring up our pal and say, this is what's going on, what can you do to help us?
I'm not quite clear about that. What kind of practical problems would they help you with? What kind of resources?
Well, when a wireless set went wrong, and they did frequently go wrong, but beyond the limits of our capability to repair it, well, then it had to go into Ordnance for treatment.
I see. So any major breakdowns,
major
maintenance, Ordnance Corps.
Yes.
You also drew attention to special arrangements that you had to make for your batteries. Is this the appropriate time to raise that?
Yes, I think so. In those days, we had 6-volt, 120-ampere-hour batteries in wooden cases, great big heavy things they were, and two of these batteries were required in every tank to run the wireless equipment. These batteries had to be kept charged, and this was one of our responsibilities. If a battery ran down, of course, there was no communication. In order to do this, we had a charging lorry with each battalion signal section, equipped with an engine. I think it was a Lister, an old slow-speed petrol-driven, I think it was, not paraffin, I think it was petrol-driven engine, which was capable of charging, I don't know how many batteries at a time, I've forgotten, but anyway, this is the equipment which we had for the purpose. And a little later on, if not in the early stages, I'm not quite sure, perhaps, we had small charging engines driven by Douglas twin-cylinder opposed motorcycle engines. We had these smaller charging engines which could be used for charging a pair of batteries. Whether they could take more, I again can't remember, but they were available for smaller numbers of batteries.
Now, we've been talking about the pattern of activities at Tidworth. As you've described them, was this the pattern that characterized the four-year period you were at Tidworth?
Yes, I think it's fair to say that was so, yes.
Just wondered if there were any sort of significant breakthroughs which affected your work at Tidworth.
Well, apart from things like promotion exams coming up from time to time and garrison activities of one kind and another, no, this was the pattern.
Good. I'd like to talk a bit about your equipment, your wireless equipment, but only from the point of view of its main characteristics.
Yeah.
We'll leave the other details, the operational details, until we start talking about work with the battalion. But if I could just get some picture about the nature of the beast, that would be helpful. First of all, I wasn't absolutely clear from an earlier conversation about whether the MBMC set, which was the one that you had throughout this period, and which was the main wireless equipment of the Army, I suppose almost up to the war.
Only in the, for the armoured vehicles?
Yes.
Not generally, yes.
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 I wasn't clear whether the MBMC set was in fact one wireless set or two wireless sets.
Well, it was one wireless installation. It consisted of two main components, a transmitter and a receiver. These were separate. In addition, there was a rotary generator to provide the high-tension supply for the transmitter, and there was a battery, a dry battery, made up of individual inert cells to provide the high-tension supply for the receiver. In addition, there were these two large 6-volt batteries, and then there was the aerial equipment, and there were no less than 32 leads connecting, which had to be screwed together with nuts and bolts and washers and so forth, to connect all these bits and pieces together. And there was a large, heavy wrought iron frame in which all this equipment was assembled. And this had to be bolted into the tank as well.
I was confused about whether it was one set or two, because... Mm. Last time you gave me the impression that the MB set was a separate set from the MC set and was a stronger set, and that it was used in special purposes like for command tanks and so on.
Yes, in point of fact, it was exactly the same set, but the power amplifier, part of the transmitter of the MBMC set, was slightly less powerful in the case of the MC. I think it may have been that there were... I've forgotten how many valves were used in the power amplifier now, but there may have been one or two more valves operating in the MB than in the MC in the power amplifier, but otherwise the set was identical.
Why did you not call these sets the MB set and the MC set rather than the MBMC set?
I'm afraid this distance and time I just cannot remember. The set really was just the same set. It was merely a question of a slightly more powerful power amplifier in the transmitter.
I see, fine.
But the dimensions were the same and the controls were the same and everything was the same.